We're ready. Simon Borchardt said he's got a little reaction from the UK. Oak's not too chuffed that we've got Pollock on the cover.
Not the bomb bashing.
They don't mind the bomb bashing. Against the Bulls, when they had conceded 33 points.
Did you give them a team talk, mate?
Sadly, no. Otherwise, it may have been the Bulls in their
final. It was a bloke with pink glasses came in.
Investec Champions Cup final, 52,000 people, an incredible occasion. Simon Borchardt, SA Rugby Magazine's brilliant editor, sent me a WhatsApp and he said, who wouldn't want to be part of this? How can South Africa even think of pulling out of the Investec Champions Cup? Surely you'd want to see a South African team there playing in the grand final. And I mean, how do you disagree with that? And then it came to me. The game ended and they went on to the next game, SA Cup final. And I thought, that's where we would be.
Yeah, we don't want to be there.
If we pulled out of the Investec Champions Cup and we went back to a 14-team Curry Cup, that's where we would be watching a game in Kimberley, potentially somewhere else, having mismatches. We have to want to be part of this occasion. Bordeaux Bagley have won it twice in a row in their history.
Incredible.
In their history. So to lose six times and Leinster four times, and the way they're going, it will stay at four for a while. But that's how hard it is to win it. So don't despair, South Africa. We've been there for three seasons, not 31. Just commit to it because it is the greatest club rugby tournament and you have to be exceptional as a club team to win it. And for me, Bordeaux are exceptional.
Oh, that was beautiful, mate.
Cut.
You basically ran it over the try line and then gave me the ball. I'm just going to put it down. Absolutely. That I agree on all counts there. I think South Africa are invested in the Champions Cup. And I think they are going to stick around. We are going to stick around. It'll be crazy to pull out of it. As much as it is taxing on multiple fronts, I think there's a lot of value in it. And you saw at the weekend, that final. Sensational. What a fantastic display of rugby. Bordeaux just on another level. And to do that to a team as vaunted as Leinster in a final where it counts the most is something to behold. And then also, mate, just to be able to do that back-to-back. I mean, to go back-to-back and win the European Champions Cup twice in a row, that puts them in elite company.
But listening to the interviews afterwards, and very impressed, most of them spoke English as well, they say it all started at halftime in Pretoria against the Bulls when they had conceded 33 points.
Did you give them a team talk, mate?
Sadly, no. Otherwise, it may have been the Bulls in their final.
It was a bloke with pink glasses came in.
But they had picked their best squad to come to South Africa.
Yeah.
And the halftime talk was, you either decide you want to be one-star wonders or you actually want to win this thing, because if we beat the Bulls and come out and turn this around in the second half. This was the narrative that they were all talking about.
Yep.
If we can beat the Bulls here, turn it around, we can go on and basically win our pool, play our games, a quarterfinal, last 16 through to semifinal at home, and back ourselves to beat anyone in a neutral venue. And the way they played in that second half, and I was fortunate to be there that day, was just watching a test team that was reminiscent of a very, very good Springbok team or All Blacks team. They just dismantled the Bulls, and it was the kicking game. So in the beginning, it was Jalibert, Bioberi. They were causing chaos in the first half on attack, but loose. And then that second half, it was Luku, Maxime Luku and Jalibert. Their kicking game just undid the Bulls. The Bulls never got out of their 22, basically. Didn't score a point in the second half, 46-33. So it started in Pretoria, and for them to go eight matches in a row, Carlos Sardi, the South African, started in all eight at tight end, did 40 minutes, and Big Ben came on and did the rest, won some turnovers and gave the crowd lots to cheer about. But there's such a lesson in that for our South African teams. And I know you'll love that stat. 31 kicks to Leinster's 19. You talk about exits and why we struggle. They banded deep to Luku. He just took it and banded back 50 meters and said, let's start again. And then they just smashed them defensively. They made 213 tackles and only missed 18. 92% tackle efficiency. And they were dominant in their tackles as well.
I mean, you summed it up, mate. I don't really know what to add to that. Maxime Lucu's on another level. The French, as you've mentioned before, produced some fantastic scrum off, specifically looking at the tactical side of the game, being able to control the game with the boot. Maxime Lucu, Antoine Dupont, the list goes on. And Lucu's ability to kick from nine distance the way that he does really is a game changer, because it simplifies and streamlines their kicking game. You're not having to set up phases. You're not having to sort of get ready for the kick and then chase it. It's literally from source. He's banging it long and hitting the target. And that just brings their kick error rate down. It increases their net kick meters. And it's a total game changer. So I think that it's a fabulous team, the balance of that side. And what I like most about Bordeaux is that they seem to be a team that their objective is to win, and win at any and all costs. And they found statistically the most efficient way to do that. They've got bangers where they need them in carrying the ball. They've got hammers making tackles when they need to. And they control where the game is played. And I think that's a very difficult combination to get around. And when you've got a bloke who's 190 million kilograms coming off the bench like Big Ben, and he's replacing a guy like Carlo Sardi, who weighs the same as a Hilux. You know, you've got the staunch scrum. You're going forward in contact on both sides of the ball, and you're doing it on the right side of the field because Maxime Lucu's doing good things. And then he's got this great familiarity with Jalibert, where when it's time to switch it on and play, it's like they're twin brothers. They know exactly where the other guy is. They create the space, and who better to take advantage of the space then Louis Bialbiari.
And then having a midfield like Fofana and then Penno, who's moved from the wing into the centre. Big, physical. And I mean, they were so dominant in the tackle area, in the collisions against Leinster, but throughout the season. But if you go back and you look at that All Black side, 2011 to 2015, the Richie McCaw side, you look at the back-to-back BOC World Cup winning side, 19 and 23, and you look at this Bordeaux side, what they've all consistent in is they can defend. They score spectacular tries, but they survive on 45% ball, 40% ball, and they score those five tries a game. But their stats are always defined by magnificent defense, and they defend their line. But because they score such good tries, people are like, what an attacking side. No, what a very good, balanced rugby side. And like they know, you've got to have a scrum, you've got to have a line-out, you've got to have a set piece, you've got to have a kicking game, and you've got to tackle. And then the rest will come. And so everyone raves about the Bordeaux's attacking brilliance. But the big games, they win it through their defense. That Toulouse quarterfinal, they spent the first 15 minutes on their try line defending against Toulouse. Took everything out of Toulouse. Reminded me of the box against England in the 2019 final. That first kind of like 25, 30 minutes, how the box just defended before halftime. And then came through and won it. And I think there were just so many lessons for our South African teams of what it takes to actually win this competition. And it's the closest you're going to get club rugby to test rugby.
Big time. No doubt. No doubt. I mean, it really is the closest. You could feel that energy in that game. The margins are narrow, even though in this particular one, it was a blowout win. But just the quality across the park, all the way to the 23rd player in each match day squad, there are no doppies in these European Champions Cup finals.
Well, Leinster, 21 of their 23 fully capped test internationals, 14 Irish internationals and an All Black. Rico Ioane on the win. That's a test team out there.
Big time.
Against a Barbarians 15. A lot of French players and a couple of other foreigners, Big Ben being one of them. Guy who's played for Tonga and he had played for the All Blacks. Quite ironic. The All Blacks didn't really see the value in him. He's become one of the superstars of Bordeaux, and he gets through 30-odd games a season. But if you just look at the quality of that Leinster side, and we've spoken about it, some guys aging, some guys are coming in, they should have come in a bit earlier. But no sooner had the end whistle blown, and we knew it would come, Jacques Ninomer was the reason that Leinster lost this game. The defensive system has failed, and it's time to move on. And I've written a piece on the blog to say, in defense, nice play on words, of Jacques Ninomer, and reminding people he won back-to-back World Cups. He beat a British and Irish Lions team in the most incredibly difficult circumstances during COVID. And he won a rugby championship as BOC coach. There's nothing wrong with Jacques Ninomer's defensive system. It's the application of players who physically weren't up to it to implement it. Over to you, Marsden. Yeah.
So, Matey, I mean, like, for where I stand, and we said this at the time, Jacques was always going to have his work cut out for him being such a defense-minded coach who built the Great Wall of Newlands, joining a team like Leinster, who are probably more like Bishops or traditionally are in their thinking, or UCT, you know, running rugby since 1882, that mindset, to bring a guy who's a staunch defender into that setup and to change the culture of a team that has been very, very successful, I always thought was going to be a hell of a difficult job, because you've got to change people's minds there. It's, you know, you're fighting for hearts and minds in that environment. And, you know, defense is not an easy sell. You're asking people to eat their vegetables. You're not offering them their sweets, are you? I mean, the attack coach walks in, he says, we're just going to throw it around. All the players rip their shirts off and cheer. The defense coach comes and says, we're going to make 200 tackles a game. Everybody goes, boo. So it's a hard sell, defense. And when you join a team that has a culture of playing a lot of rugby and kind of equates offloads and line breaks with their identity, I think it's very difficult to kind of bring the mindset in that you need. And I'm not saying that Leinster have, you know, ignored Jacques or, you know, disregarded him. I think they've made a good effort to take on board what he does. But there really has to be follow through the whole way through the organization for that to happen, so that it permeates the players. And I think that's maybe where the evolution is still not complete. I think bringing Jacques in is obviously a masterstroke. They've obviously identified that defense was an area that really needed to improve. But I would say probably the most important person in an organization for the defense coach is the attack coach. Because if the attack coach is unleashing wild, freestyle, unpredictable rugby, it puts the defense in very difficult situations. And I'm not saying that is the case at Leinster. I'm just saying that is something that has to be managed. The defense coach kind of has to clean up after the attack when things don't work out. And Leinster are very much an attack-first minded team. So I think it's been very difficult for him. I think Jacques has probably learned a hell of a lot, but it's been frustrating at times. And then you mentioned some of the players there. I mean, they've got guys that have done great things for Ireland, played for the British and Irish Lions, fantastic players. But maybe, and we've seen this with teams like the Springboks before, maybe those guys who are entrenched, it's quite difficult to move them on because they've really been so successful. When you've got a tier of up-and-comers like, for me, Kieran Frawley, Jamie Osborne, Tommy O'Brien, those oaks are pushing hard for starting opportunities. And I think, you know, it's easy in hindsight to say, oh, you should have made the switch, and, you know, you should have made the change. But they're kind of at that point where they've almost gone too far into the tenure. So I think Frawley's leaving to go to Connacht now. That's a big loss for Leinster. So I think they've got the quality of play there, and they've definitely got the IP with a guy like Jacques there. I think that mindset switch is what's been missing to this point at times.
I also think, and look, they did well to win the URC last season, beat the Bulls in the final. And they relied on home ground advantage, obviously playing at the Aviva. But 2018 was the last time they've won the Investec Champions Cup. They've gone to five finals and lost all five finals. Most of them before Jacques Nienaber arrived in Dublin, and they've been beaten before the finals in the others. It's been coming for a while that the style of game that gave the Irish national team such success has changed. And we saw that in that quarterfinal defeat against New Zealand. 36 phases that they took the ball through, but went nowhere. And just great defense beat a very predictable attack. And they've always relied on that fluency of the attack, their phase plan, that, and the game has evolved. Teams without the ball often are the teams that win a game, who get less ball, who play field position well, who have a very strong kicking game, and obviously a great defensive game. That's right, the Springboks. Back-to-back world champions, Bordeaux. Back-to-back Investec Champions Cup winners. It's like, has the game gone beyond what Leinster have traditionally done, and they actually aren't adapting fast enough?
I don't think that's the problem. I think what Leinster does is very, very efficient and successful, and has obviously won them championships in the past, when you can control the collisions. And the lower down in the season you are, the further you are from the sharp point of the season, the more chances there are you're going to come up against teams that are not contenders. And you can physically dominate them. And when you physically dominate them and then you apply some of the slickest attacking rugby that's ever been produced, it's incredible to watch. But when you get to the sharp end of the season, you come up against teams that can physically stop you. And then you can't play that kind of rugby off the lack of momentum, because it puts you under pressure and creates opportunities for the defense to score. And that's what Bordeaux have got right. They physically dominate and they back their defense to give their attack opportunities. They don't try physically dominate, attack, and then let their defense clean up. And I think that it sounds like semantics, but that's quite a big difference between those two things. And I think that's where Leinster keep bumping their head in the toughest, biggest games, because they're coming up against the best of clubs there. When you see them play against Zebre or the Dragons, they physically dominate the collision. They play out of that, they offload, they pull pass, they go around the corner and they're gone. And people go, wow, this is amazing attacking rugby. But you can't apply that template when you come up against a team where the first three or four phases, every ball carrier is getting dumped backwards. Then you've got to have a plan B. And if you don't kick first, you become a reactionary kicking team. And then you kind of lose control of the initiative and you kind of are now in cleanup mode. So I think they saw that, they understood that. That's why they brought Jock in. But it's more than just bringing a voice in with IP. That guy has to have the latitude, I would say, to actually get his hands on the team and sort of sink his teeth into the psyche, because you need a change of mind there. It's more than just saying, okay, when we're on defense, we need to be more efficient. You have to change the way you think about the game. That's my speculative opinion.
And if you also look at Leinster, I mean, they were spoiled to have Johnny Sexton there for more than a decade.
Yeah.
One of the best 10s. To play the game, right up there with the top five in terms of elite tens in the professional era. Harry Boone, with the greatest respect, and Sam Prendergast, who didn't play, are not in his class. And so much of Leinster's attack, so much of Leinster's rugby IP was centered around Johnny Sexton. And Harry Boone is not Johnny Sexton. And you got a Harry Boone up against a Jalibert. I mean, Harry Boone's just individual game was poor. He was pressured. Gibson Park, one of the better nines in world rugby. He's always been the form one. Him and Dupont, probably two of the best.
Yep.
Was on the back foot because they were playing side to side and backpedaling because they were getting smashed in the tackles. And then I did think they missed James Lowe's big left boot.
Big time.
And Rico Ioane did what he could do, but he doesn't have that kicking game of a James Lowe. And they were just monstered up front. And if you look at Bordeaux's final performance, you look at their semi-final against Bath, you look at their last 16 against Leicester, you look at the quarter-final against Toulouse, wow. I mean, they destroyed every one of those teams.
Yeah.
I think the least points they scored was the 30 against Toulouse. To put 30 past them, that's basically the other French, that's half of the other French national side. So I don't think it's so much that Leinster were necessarily that poor.
Totally.
Bordeaux were actually that good.
Agreed.
But it showed up where Leinster are vulnerable and are poor. And I just think, I knew it would come, but it's like such a knee-jerk reaction, so short-sighted to say the Nienaber experiment hasn't worked. Not much has worked pre-Jacques Nienaber. And what he does actually have to show for it is one URC title. He was there last season when you guys beat the Bulls and only limited them to 7 points. Everyone raved about the defense of Leinster a week ago when they basically kept the Lions down to just one try. The difference is Bordeaux is a lot better than the Lions and have a greater attacking threat. So it's, yeah, I mean, I think we're South Africans. Obviously, you don't touch one of ours. But I think it's been done a dirty there. It's been done a raw deal. And if the attitude is going to be, let's blame Jacques Nienaber, Leinster's not going to fix their problems very, very quickly. And I know that's not coming from within the club.
Yes.
I know the players rate him so highly, the respect that there is for him within the coaching staff. But the public and the kind of media and certain sections of the media just going for him. And I had to have a chuckle watching that 30 minutes between the 10th and the 42nd minute. 35 unanswered points. It was the most they focused on Jacques Nienaber throughout the season in the coach's box. But when they went in by 20 points, you never see him get focused on as well.
Truth.
It reminds me of Kevin Peterson when he was playing for England. When he scored 100, he was England's best ever batsman. When he failed, well, there was disruption. He was South African born.
Mate, not fair.
Not fair. So, big, big congratulations to Bordeaux. I thought they were outstanding. Commiserations to Jacques. Mate, you know where home is. You know where South Africa is. We know your contract is up just before the World Cup in 2027. You haven't yet extended anything. Hurry home, mate. We know your value.
Yep.
And we have players who can take your system and implement it. Talking about players, talking about systems, talking about sponsors, Steco, Hybrid, our wonderful, wonderful partners. Every week, Zales, you pick you pick the Steco Hybrid Power Tool Hero of the Week. And I was thinking of that ambassador, Andre Estenreis in the Giant. Imagine him in that Bordeaux midfield, playing next to Jalibert, playing behind a pack like that.
Oof.
He would be the player of the week every week on our show.
Le Giant.
Le Giant. Andre, Le Giant. Estenreis. Who would it be? But before you say that, as always, we got to listen. And if you don't listen, we just got to watch Andre the Giant.
Some players choose a side. They've always said a back can never be a forward. But with Steco, Ryobi didn't just reinvent the rules. It changed the entire game. Hybrid tools for a hybrid craftsman. Steco, shaping the future. 40 years of Ryobi credibility.
Man, I don't know. I never really hear Andre speak in that clip or really anywhere else. I have seen him speak in the post-match press conference, mate, but it looks like he may be reading a teleprompter. I'm not sure. Just teasing. Mate, my Steco Hybrid Power Tools Hero of the Week is not Louis Bielbiary, although he did score a great try stepping a prop in space. I'm going to give it to a hybrid from the land of the long white cloud, mate. Lester Fanganuku started at number 7 for the Crusaders in their victory over the Chiefs, scored a great try for them. He's been in vicious form in Super Rugby. I'm not sure it's going to translate to the Test Arena, but I do love Lester Fanganuku, and he did score a great try. So he's my Power Tools Hero this week.
And because you are the sole judge of it, no one argues with you.
Yes.
Awesome win for the Crusaders, puts them in the playoffs against the Chiefs. But again, cast doubts on just how good were the Chiefs and just how good is Super Rugby. JK says it's not very good. Sir Graham Henry says it's not
very
good.
We'll find out later this year.
Everyone says it's time for change. rugby's greatest rivalry. We can't wait for that. It's going to be magnificent. The All Blacks in South Africa for 3 tests, obviously. 4 matches against the URC teams. And then they go play the 4th test in Baltimore, the USA. And hopefully by that time, it will be 3-0. The series will be ours. And we'll give them that one as an exhibition game to keep the rivalry going until 2030 when the Boks go over there and play all 5 Super Rugby teams. But in 2030, will they still have Super Rugby teams? We don't know that. But again, well done to the Crusaders. Chiefs Hurricanes are on fire in New Zealand at the moment. They're pumping everyone. So keep an eye on that. And also Australia, as I keep on being reminded, we do play them the end of September. We play them in Perth after rugby's greatest rivalry tour. And then in between that, and look at this little beast, we got the Poms coming to South Africa. There you go.
Love it, mate.
What a face.
Follow on the cover.
What a face, eh? We've already, Simon Borchardt said he's got a little reaction from the UK. Oak's not too chuffed that we've got Pollock on the cover.
Not the bomb bashing.
They don't mind the bomb bashing. Got Pollock on the cover. But what we do have on the cover, and fortuitously, we got Cheslin Kolbe, 51 test machine. He's won everything. It started for the man in Cape Town, 4 Province and the Stormers, 49 matches for the Stormers. And you'll know it, you just come from the HPC. They've announced it this morning.
It's fantastic news, mate. The pocket, the ultimate pocket rocket, one of South Africa's greatest finishers, arguably the most exciting player in the world to watch in space. He's had an incredible career. It's not over yet. He's coming back to Cape Town, reuniting with the Stormers, will add massive value from an experience point of view, along with his playing ability. And that's a coup, mate, as they say.
Yeah, and I think if you look at that project, 2029, John Dobson's project, keeping Sasha here. I know Damian Willems was signed till 27. They're hoping to get him to sign till 2029. Building teams around certain players. The pack is really it's a work in progress, but it's one of the strongest packs in the competition. And that's why they were so competitive in the Investec Champions Cup, because they've got a pack who can stand up to most of these French teams. Where there has been a need for something real star qualities in the back three, it doesn't get bigger, it doesn't get better than Cheslin Kolbe. He's outstanding when he left South Africa and he went to Toulouse. That's where he really kind of put himself on the international radar. From there he went to Toulon. From there he went to Japan and has been outstanding there. This season alone, he took on the goal-kicking duties.
I was going to say, that's where
205 points in 17 matches. And he kicked them. Basically, was outstanding again over the weekend as they won their first playoff match. But what a good player to get. I mean, what do you see him bringing over and above the obvious talents, but off the field, to especially that younger generation of player coming through?
Yeah, so we do have some young guys obviously coming up from the fantastic school base that we have in the Western Cape along with the rest of the country. And a guy like Chesson Colby obviously commands instant respect from any youngster that's on the scene, anybody that's seen him play. And he's obviously got a wealth of experience and has won the biggest games. So I think from that perspective, huge add off the field value. And then on the field, I think Normie's probably super excited to have a veteran guy who's been there and done it, kind of knows the ins and outs of his defense system, just to add an extra layer to that, to the sting. And then for me, I've always thought Chesson would be great at fullback. I obviously played there as a youngster a lot, and I just think his kicking game is massively underrated. You add the experience he's got now, his ability to make people miss in space, I think you could potentially make the, you know, your counter-attack would just be unstoppable with a guy like that, potentially moonlighting at fullback. So the sort of the sky is the limit, you know. You could even say Chesson could have a few runs at fly-off as a second playmaker. He'd be brilliant.
Well, in his career, he's played two matches at fly-off, and that was for too long. He's played 169 matches. He's played on the right wing and the left wing. 42% of them have been on the right wing, 28% on the left wing, and he's played 30% of his career matches at fullback. And now he kicks as well.
And the kickers will kick.
And he's kicked 23 penalties and 43 conversions a season and scored 10 tries. So, this, you're getting a guy who can play 10, 11, 14, 15 with 51.
7-1. 7-1 split.
With 51. And forget about the kicking. He'll do the kicking for you as
Correct.
Well. He's just been outstanding. But over and above that, 32 years old, people say, 32, how are the legs going to be coping? He's so well conditioned. He's a player who can play for another 4 or 5 years. But if you look at his track record, he went when he played for the Stormers, 49 matches. He averaged 77 minutes a game in his 49 matches. He started 48 of the 49. He went to Toulon. He started 77 out of 82. A 94% return, averaged 72 minutes a game. That was Toulouse. He went to Toulon, 31 matches, 31 starts, 77% average per game. St. Goliath, he's played 42 matches. He started 98% of them, and he averages 71 minutes. So you're getting a guy who plays. He plays. He's played 70 matches for Tokyo St. Goliath this season. He's advanced him already in the playoffs. He's taken on additional responsibilities. You're not getting a bloke who plays 55 minutes, who misses half the season.
Spot on.
Everywhere he's gone since he made his debut in 2013 and then went on to the global stage, he has given everything. He's worth every penny that they've put together through the pony money, third-party sponsorships, and obviously the Stormers. And I think he's one of, outside of signing Sasha to 29 for me, he's one of those guys, one of the originals you just wanted to bring home. And well done to the Stormers.
Spot on.
And to the Stormers ownership, Johan Le Roux, well done, mate. Andre Fanafian, for dipping into your pockets and bringing that guy home.
Yeah.
Well done also for Paul Roos beating Paul Boisard, by the way. I know.
What a segue!
Yeah. And Johan's son is in Bishops. Can you believe that, eh? You go to Paul Roos and send your kid to Bishops. And they won a game of rugby finally. They edged Durbanville. So great stuff in the Western Cape. Chesson Colby, he is the story. King Colby is back. Cover of SA Rugby magazine. You put him on the cover and you ask by him.
Mate, how did you know?
So that is just, that's just the good news story in South Africa this week.
Totally.
That he will be back, and he'll be back playing for the Stormers next season. We don't have to wait till after the World Cup. He's going to be released early from his contract. And he spoke glowingly in his press release and his social media posts about playing in Japan, the Japanese culture, the people. He has been one of the great ambassadors of that strong, strong South African legion in Japan. I bumped into Oak on Saturday morning, mate, and he is a big fan of yours. And apparently a big fan of mine. He asked for a photo in the pharmacy.
Yes.
And he said that he and his mates get hammered every time they watch our show, because every time I say Storms or Sax,
they have to have a drink.
And every time you say Fabulous, they say
Fabulous.
So every time
have another one, boys.
Yeah. So every time you say Fabulous, they sink one and they say it's Stormers and Sax on my side.
Fantastic.
So I'm going to get them an early start here. I thought that Sax were fabulous in between Carl Fallet and ending the unbeaten run. I thought the Stormers were fabulous because they couldn't lose this weekend. You know, Jandre Gilbert, we shout out to him, our social media manager. It was his daughter's 9th, Leandre. And he had a great day. He's an Arsenal supporter. He had a great Saturday. Arsenal got the title. He said the Bulls couldn't lose and the Stormers couldn't win. He's a Bulls fan, by the way.
Just slightly.
So, yeah, I mean, it's going to be a big week. We're focusing on URC. It's the playoffs. The Investec Champions Cup is gone. Yep. Stormers up against Cardiff. The Bulls, obviously, they host Munster. And the Lions are away to Leinster. When I say away, they stayed in Ireland, so I don't know who's footing the ball, but they have never came home. They've been there for the past week and a half after playing against Leinster a fortnight ago and then playing against Munster and losing. They will have been in Ireland for a month, so they can't complain about the effects of sea, the sea level, because there is no altitude there. It's just going to be attitude. But we are going to be back, Zalzi. But before we back on Thursday, I know that you got some schools results that you love talking about. You know, there was a big win for one of your teams in the KZN area.
Mate, you're going to have to help me on this. My computer's just died. But from what I can remember, I think Westville, massive win against Glenwood, mate. I can't remember the exact score, but a huge win against Glenwood. I'm not sure what's happened in Glenwood, mate. I know Millerton just down the road from me took a massive hiding. Was it Bullet Lunbow? Somebody put some points on them.
It wasn't Tableview.
It wasn't Tableview. I can tell you that for free. Yeah, mate. And then you mentioned the Paul Roos result. You've mentioned the Bishops and the Sachs results. Rondebosch lost out to Stellenberg. What else was there? What have I missed? Uffies. Uffies was a huge win over your mates at Kez, mate.
Yeah,
what's going on there?
I thought Kez did well to get 28 points. But they got beaten. If you look in the Nutball, you go on to SA Rugby Magazine, but go to schoolboyrugby.co.za. They have all the results. Like, there's like from every school, whether you're ranked 200th in the country, whether you're ranked first, all the results are there from the Eastern Cape, KZN, and obviously the Western Cape and the Free State. But the thing that's been doing the rounds also on those schoolboy rugby blogs is the professionals of the game. Like, your top schools are now basically rugby academies. And should they still be playing in those traditional games that for historically the last 50, 100 years they've been playing, or is it unfair that there are now, like, there's probably 12 big elite schools out there. Should they not just be playing in their own 11 matches against each other and let the other schools actually just go out and enjoy schoolboy rugby and treat those games as you would like one extended winter of schoolboy rugby festivals?
I mean, mate, yes. I would say yes. I think there needs to be a distinction between serious rugby schools and sort of institutes of education and academics that have sports programs. I think the gray area between that, you're potentially putting kids in sort of in the firing line. There's some player safety issues around that. I think if you've got a guy who's training, you know, 18 days a week and on a full program against a guy who's just doing well at mass and wants to have a run around at the ball. So I think you do need some sort of an idea around who your serious rugby schools are and maybe catch those together. But as soon as you do that, you start to, I suppose, stand on the toes of people who like the tradition and history of it. So there will be cases if you do that where staunch rugby schools traditionally who don't follow the money ball and money professionalism of schoolboy rugby are going to be left behind, and then some old rivalries are going to disappear, I suppose, in that environment. Or you've got the thirds playing the firsts or whatever. So I think it is a very tricky situation. Anytime you have growth, you kind of break some eggshells, and I think that's where schoolboy rugby is right now. I don't think the commercialization of schoolboy rugby can really be stopped because I think there'll be too much collateral damage around that. So I think some schools are going to embrace it and run towards it and others aren't. And I don't think there's a right or wrong way, but I do like your idea of a distinction between the schools that are chasing that sort of professionalism and the ones who want to stay purely academic, you know. I think that is important.
Yeah, and I think there are, like we said, 10 to 12 schools that really have rugby programs in place.
Yeah.
And you see that. And I don't see the value in a team winning 76-14 against a traditional rival, because they have a far more balanced approach to sport, culture, arts, and their academics.
Yeah.
And that's something I think the schools have to look at and say, hang on a second, we may have played you for 100 years, but do we really want to be playing you now and every one of our teams takes a whipping? No.
Yeah.
Let's kind of make it strength against strength. Let's make it enjoyable for all the schoolboys.
Mm.
And because, I mean, it is. It's the schoolboy who's gifted, who's the potential Stormer or Bulls or Lions or Sharks player or Springbok, doesn't necessarily have to come out of one of those elite schools. That person's talent will come to the fore, and we've seen it. They go into an under-19 structure, or they go into an academy at one of the clubs, and they make it.
Mm. But even if they don't, mate, you can't subject the other 14 players in that guy's team to 100-0 defeats every week because, you know, this guy needs to be showcased. I think there's two sides to that coin. That guy needs to find his way, I suppose, to a more serious rugby school or roll the dice and playing where he's at. But I think if you're trying to accommodate everybody, you end up accommodating nobody. And I think the demand is demanding the sort of evolution in schoolboy rugby where people are seeing the opportunity long term. The same way kids take their geography seriously if they want to be a geologist, kids who want to be a professional rugby player are going to take their rugby seriously at school. And I think this is the evolution of that.
You coached at schoolboy level as well. I mean, do you see as the dramatic changes?
I think it's become more organized. I mean, if you look at rugby in the 80s and you go watch those tapes now, you're just shocked that every time someone touches the ball, they don't score because there's no organized defense. Folks are just running. It's one-on-one tackling. And I think the way that the professional game has evolved from that now, defense has become so organized, so structured, and the shape of it has changed completely. It used to be all scrums and lineouts. Now you've got a lot more ball in play. And I think that sort of evolution has seeped into the schoolboy scene where now people are taking it more seriously. When I was at school, you didn't have a defense coach. You had a head coach. There was a coach for your team. That was it. Now you've got guys on payroll who specifically are there to coach the team. They're not even teachers at the school. So it's become more organized. And as that has happened, that sort of arms race has accelerated. You're scouting kids at primary school to come to your high school now on bursaries. You've got a gym in some cases. You've got programs. Guys are on a diet. You know, they've got nutrition. It's become very organized and very professional. And I think that you can't now pull up the handbrake on that. You've kind of already crossed that point of no return. And I think you just need to make sure that you, like you suggested, that kids who are not part of that kind of arms race are not exposed to, you know, a nuclear blast.
Yeah, and there's ranking systems. You look at super sports schools, everything's on live streaming, it's televised. The commercial programs that are in place, I think we saw a story a couple of weeks ago. Some schools are investing 5-6 million rand in terms of salaries and into their rugby programs. That's just for the first team alone. So I get that. I really am such a lover of schoolboy rugby, but the festival schoolboy rugby, the traditional one, I've always kind of taken these rankings with a pinch of salt.
Mm.
And I don't know how much good it does to players or schools outside of the supposed top 20 or top 30. I think there's a place for both. Where we used to have rugby academies, now you've just got those 12 schools that are effectively rugby academies.
Mm.
But don't let them be playing against even traditional rivals who they're caning by 70 or 80 points. It does nothing to those Saturday mornings. All it means is, you know, that they used to say, like in the southern suburbs, the schoolmasters take that schedule and know when kids are going to have flu. when they have to hit the road to Paul.
N1 fever, yeah.
N1 fever. It's not going to happen. We're going to be back on Thursday chatting URC quarterfinals. Zales, I hope the Oaks read your notes. They didn't read your notes when they went to Cardiff to play Cardiff. I hope they read your notes this week when they play Cardiff at home. We'll chat in more detail. There's still a month to go. SA Rugby Magazine, 100,000 rand cash prize. If you sign up, give your registration details, you also get the DigiMag. You can download it for free. It's a wonderful mag. Pom bashing, as always. Simon Borchard and his team. Exquisite and brilliant. As destructive and as potent as Bordeaux were.